Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 249 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Deepo Agboluwaje speaks with Gabriel Badamosi about Britain and Nigeria, the big dreams of his characters and his knack of combining satire with character development, and the necessity for diverse playwrights to aim for the mainstream.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Badamosi, and I'm sitting here with Oladipo Agboluwaje, Deepo for short. Deepo Agboluwaje is a British-Nigerian playwright. He burst onto the scene in 2003 with his play, Early Morning, a left-field satire on the lives and aspirations of Nigerian office cleaners, shaking their mops and brooms at second-class invisible lives in the British economy. Since then, he's continued to surprise and shock audiences into laughter with plays such as The Estate and its prequel, Yale, The First Wife, loosely inspired by Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard, in which class, the master-servant relationship rather than race or its politics, drives the characters and plot. Born and brought up in London and then educated in Nigeria, Deepo describes himself as an Arsenal fan. Deepo, tell us, an Arsenal fan, is that for the humiliation under Arsene Wenger, the continual string of losses and decline at the football club?
That's what it did within the past 10 years. But prior to that, when I lived in Nigeria, I think I must have been the only living, breathing Arsenal fan that most Nigerians had ever met at that time, because they were nowhere near where they were in the late 80s, early 90s under the previous manager, George Graham. Sadly, it was only after I left Nigeria that they began to climb under the first half of Arsene Wenger's tenure. But yeah.
Was supporting Arsenal a way of continuing to hold on to your London life whilst you were in Nigeria? I think for a decade or two.
Yes, I would say that was part of it, because it's not that I didn't support Nigerian teams. I did. I supported, there was a Nigerian team in Ibadan called the IICC Shooting Stars, you know, a very colourful name team. And that was the team I supported in Nigeria. But I think, yes, I was always looking out for the football results on the BBC World Service, you know, for the Football League results, Division One as it was then before it became the Premiership. And unlike most Nigerian fans who would follow whichever team was the best team of the day, you know, they couldn't understand why I was a staunch Arsenal supporter, because in Nigeria nobody supports a loser, as I was told once when I revealed I was an Arsenal fan. So it was partly to do with a rootedness in Britain that remained and came with me when I came to Nigeria.
In relation to supporting success, I think one of the kind of great successes you've had in your theatre career here in this country is the way that you've managed to surprise your audiences. So, for example, The Estate, when it came to the Soho Theatre in London, completely shocked the Nigerian audiences, who suddenly saw themselves on the stage. Yes. And their surprise, their delight, was also somehow their horror at being disclosed. This dramaturgy of surprise, how have you sustained it in your career?
Well, I think it was very much to do with the satires that I was watching when I was growing up in Nigeria. There were a lot of the Yoruba language satires. They actually made me want to learn Yoruba when I returned to England, because I'd see the reaction...
When I returned to Nigeria.
Because I'd see the reaction on my father's face, how he'd laugh out loud when watching those comedies, as opposed to when we were watching the English or American comedies that were also popular on TV. And I wanted to know what exactly, and I, you know, made him laugh so loud in such a way. And it could only be through language. And I realised it was particularly the satirical pieces, because of the Yoruba fondness for, you know, play on words and for exaggeration, and how those comedians would situate those situations in everyday, you know, in everyday situations, and how they would spiral out of control. how logic becomes illogical and at the same time logical again was what inspired me to want to write in that way, to place ordinary situations in front of an audience and watch them follow the logic with disbelief, but yet say, well, actually, if A equals B, then of course it's C. But still they don't see it coming.
I remember watching on Nigerian television Baba Sala, the great Yoruba comedian.
Yes.
And his form of comedy was character-based as well as situation-based.
Yes.
So do you see yourself as writing a combination of situation comedy and character-based comedy in the same way?
Yes. I remember having a discussion with a director who had seen... No, he hadn't seen the play. He'd read it. And he said to me that what he found the most interesting about them wasn't so much as the use of humour, but in the fact that I was able to combine satire, you know, which is very much about situations spiraling out of control, you know, or sending up of characters, with character development of drama. So you get to a point in the story where all of a sudden it isn't funny anymore, he said. At the same time, he realised that if I didn't write it in that satirical style, that moment would never work. So I would say, yes, it's a cry to combine the two. I think it's because, much as I'm setting up these characters, I actually have a love for them as well, because I understand the kind of situations that they're struggling in, particularly in a country like Nigeria, where everything is at stake, you know. It's about where will people get their next meal from. Even just a case of marrying the right person, you know, whether is it for love or for survival. It's the choices those characters make. It's satirical, but the stakes are very high. They're very, very high. It is about what happens to me tomorrow, you know.
Well, let's make the contrast. On Nigerian television, there was, for a very long time, a very popular satirical program called Bassey and Co., written by the late executed Nigerian writer and oil activist Ken Saro-Wiwa. It had a wonderful punchline: to be a millionaire, think like a millionaire. And in a way, it was looking at the kind of the oil-inflated kind of corruption of Nigeria, with, on the one hand, very high stakes for people to kind of earn their next meal, and on the other hand, kind of untold wealth salting itself everywhere around the world, from Switzerland to New York, but certainly into London.
Yeah.
When it comes to you putting on plays in London and you're looking at Nigerians in London, what are you seeing? What are you satirising?
I am satirising that mentality that Ken Saro-Wiwa satirised in Bassey and Company, and the mindset that was also satirised by comedians like Baba Sala, who you already mentioned. And in a sense, what I'm looking at is how the social economic backdrop of a country like Nigeria affects its people. The way in which, as you said, the inequalities in wealth affect the way all relationships of society. So you imagine where in a place like the Ogoni land, the Delta region of Nigeria, where most of the oil comes from, and it's in abject poverty, the spoliation of the environment. And yet there seems to be nothing happening. There's no advancement. They can't go forward. And every time they try to move forward, there are serious consequences, like what happened with Ken Saro-Wiwa. So this is a life and death struggle that these people are facing. But if you think of it in terms of the nation and the nation state, what does it do for all the relationships, based on ethnicity, based on religion, based on gender? It just permeates the whole society. So what I wanted a Nigerian audiences in London to see was an honest look at the state of the nation.
Nigeria.
And yes, of Nigeria. An honest look at their own country, without the kind of generalizations that you see in a lot of dramas where plays that are set in Africa, if they're written, for instance, by a British writer who has little or no connection to Nigeria, takes on this kind of pseudo-universal kind of story about life and living and so on and so forth, but isn't quite as conversant with the politics that create those characters. And so you have these generic Africans on stage, you know, whether they're from Nigeria or from Ghana or from wherever, and the specific politics of the nation state that looms large in the background is the politics of what we read in the newspapers or see on TV. Whereas I'm writing it from somebody who's lived in that country, who may know a few little things about certain personalities or about certain situations that I can add into the mix that only a Nigerian audience would know. So yes, they're seeing it in England. They're watching it in England. There's a mixed, diverse audience around them. But there are certain things, and they're watching, and the dynamic in the audience is like, oh my God, I can't believe he said that. And they turn around, and if they're sitting next to an English person, that's gone straight over his head.
So you're very much playing with your audiences.
I wouldn't want to say playing with them, but I would want to say that what I'm trying to do is to say that there are two or more audiences who come to see the play, and I try to serve each one. But there's a sense in which I want a Nigerian audience to understand that this play is written about them by a person who comes from that culture, who understands some of those problems. I always have a Nigerian audience in mind when I write those plays, because it's the only way I can write with sincerity about those situations that I'm writing about.
These are dispatches from the front line of contemporary Nigeria for audiences in London, some of them Nigerian and plugged in, and others of them perhaps a little bewildered, but nevertheless interested.
Exactly. And I remember that there was a night when there was an Indian couple that came to see the estate, and they were laughing their heads off and nodding to each other like, yep, that's India. That's India.
Okay, all right. Your particularity has become universal, clearly. But let me take you to a play that you wrote for Rural Torium in England, about two West African kind of migrants who stow themselves away, effectively, land and are making their way to Covent Garden, which they think is the mecca of theatre, and they wish to put on a show. In many ways, you were kind of learning new skills, how to speak to an audience you didn't really know so intimately. How did that go?
Well, yes, well, the play was called For One Night Only, and as you said, it's about these two West Africans. I think one's Nigerian, one's Sierra Leonean, and both have the same dream, coincidentally. They're both musicians and have the same dream. They've got it into their heads that Covent Garden is this Las Vegas of Britain, you know, where once they get there and perform, they will become superstars. And so they are illegal immigrants, and they decide, chase the dream, they'll get to Covent Garden, but they can't read a train timetable, so they end up travelling all and everywhere except to London. And yes, the idea behind that at first was to highlight the plight of immigrants, illegal immigrants. And I was thinking to myself, and I was saying, well, I'd seen a lot of plays like that, and because I come from a West African background, what I didn't want was to write a play that was, in a sense, worthy. I knew these kind of people. Again, you know, I spoke about the sort of desperation that you see in certain peoples in Nigeria, in a world of wealth, you know, extreme wealth, and yet there's extreme desperation. So I knew those characters. These were people who dreamed big. And I thought that what I would do is then write a story that could encompass the largeness of their dreams. And as you said, it was writing for a different audience that would be mainly a white, British, non-cosmopolitan.
Rural English story.
Yes.
Can I bring you towards what you're describing in an outline for One Night Only, which is the enormity of the dreams and aspirations of the characters? This seems to be something which is continuous throughout all of your plays. They all seem to look at, particularly Nigerian characters, who are what we used to describe as overreachers. These people are reaching for the stars.
Yes.
And in some way, you're in a position of partly sympathising, but completely lampooning them at the same time. You're running with the hare and hunting with the hounds, aren't you?
In a sense, yes. I do feel for those characters because I understand why their dreams are so big. I understand why they make certain decisions that would seem strange to everybody else. And I think my job as a writer is not to create a situation where the dreams are the same kind of dreams that everybody has, that everybody can relate to, for fear that non-Nigerian audiences won't understand and think, why are these people acting like idiots? And so that's not my job. My job is to put those dreams on stage and then show how and why these characters behave in a certain way within the confines of that play. That's my job. It is not to Europeanize the thinking and the thought processes of these people. It's actually to put them as they are. I've had conversation with these kinds of people. I actually had an old schoolmate who tried to cross the Sahara Desert to Europe. And he failed and he had to come all the way back. This was before I returned to London. And I remember him telling me his story and the matter-of-fact way he told it. And why not? You know, I wanted a better life. Why not? You can't have a better life just sitting back and doing nothing and waiting for things to happen. And that's the thing about Nigerians, why they make such great dramatic characters. These are people who believe in action.
But Postcards from the Sahara, there's something in the way that you're approaching these subjects which makes me think they'll get their just desserts.
Well, in a way, because sometimes you ask the question, I think the question at the back of my mind, and I think it's a critique of myself as well, we left Nigeria, and there are young people leaving Nigeria. What if we decided to stay and make a stand against corruption, against the leaders who loot the coffers, against leaders who impoverish a wealthy nation that is wealthy not just in oil, but in agriculture, in mineral resources, and in manpower? You know, why is it that a country of such resourceful people has one of the highest unemployment rates amongst young people? What hope is there for young people in that country? So in a sense, it's almost a sense of an indictment of us all abdicating our responsibility, and I include myself in that.
Do you have a relationship to, in many ways, the godfather of our generation of Nigerian artists, Fela Kuti, who spoke, who sang, who used Pidgin English and some Yoruba to devastating effect to engage and conscientize ordinary Nigerians to stand up against the existing power structure, of which he was nominally a part?
Oh, yeah.
Are you somehow under his spell?
Yes. Although I recognize that he was more or less a populist. You know, if we were to define him, he was more of a populist.
He's a rabble-rouser, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. But his politics were more on the side of populism. But irrespective of that, yes, he, I think, looms largest in terms of my creative inspiration. When I wrote The Estate and when I wrote Iyale, he'd be playing in the background. And I was using him as a creative inspiration to remind myself of the Nigeria that I lived in, of the Nigeria he was talking about. Also, I think I was also using him for inspiration because of his fearlessness. As you said, he was a rabble-rouser. And he was very fearless. He'd sing against the government. They'd arrest him. They'd beat him. Release him. And he'd be back again in the recording studio, singing again, you know. He never, ever let up.
An irrepressible rebel.
Irrepressible rebel. And I think there's a part of me that aspires to that. I don't think I'm that brave, but there's a part of me, particularly when I was young, that aspired to that. That indomitable spirit that said, others may flee the country, and some of them whose their lives are not even being threatened, some are leaving because of the economic problems and so on and so forth, but I'm going to stay.
Let me come back to other influences in your work. So we haven't mentioned yet that you're also an academic with a doctorate in West African and Southern African theatre.
Yes.
The Estate was inspired by Chekhov, The Cherry Orchard. You've done a version of Bertolt Brecht's Mother Courage,
yes,
with which you had some sort of battles with The Estate to try and allow them, get them to allow you to update the sensibility. But also in another of your plays, The Christ of Cold Harbour Lane, which is set in contemporary Brixton, I see very much the influence of the Nobel laureate playwright, Wole Soyinka, particularly his play The Road and the Brother Jiro plays,
yes,
which lampoon sort of false preachers. Looking at all of the influences that go into your work, something is telling me that, yes, this is African theatre, but it's also European theatre,
yes,
somehow in collision. How does that work for you as you come to a new project?
Well, I guess it depends on what I'm writing about. I think for me, the influences are, they're there because reading writers like Wole Soyinka in university, you know, they were already writing in a sort of Euro-African tradition anyway, you know. Even the local language dramatists that we spoke of were influenced by Western staging techniques as well. So I would say that that syncretism was already a given, in a sense. When I started reading a lot of the African plays, I'd say my main influence at the time was Ngugi Wa Thiong'o when I was in university.
The Kenyan writer.
Ngugi Wa Thiong'o was one of my main influences, if not the main influence at the time. Because, again, it was that sense of identifying with the common people, looking at history, but from the point of view of the subalterns, the working classes. Ngugi Wa Thiong'o once said that in Africa there are only two tribes, the rich and the poor. And that was something that I agreed with, that if only the different groups could, just for a few minutes, ignore their ethnic and religious differences and see the reality of their situations in society, that those who were exploiting them were also from their own ethnicities, were also from their own religion. It made no difference.
This makes me kind of think that perhaps you might be impatient discovering a situation in Britain in which there's such a thing as black theatre as distinct from what? White theatre? How do you deal with the whole kind of issue around kind of black race here in Britain when it comes to making work?
It's a thorny issue. Before I started writing in England, I used to attend a lot of theatre conferences that dealt with the situation of black British theatre. And it was very hard at first, me coming from Nigeria, from a country where race was not the issue in terms of access to maybe it's the stage or anything else. And then to come to England and then see that this was actually a really a big problem. And so for me, I remember once saying, well, at one conference, you know, speaking up and saying, I can understand where we're all coming from, but I think maybe the only way through this is the kind of autonomy that you have in say, African-American theatre, where they had their own urban circuit, which is sort of derogatory, was known as the Chitlin Circuit. It's the only way, because I couldn't see how we could transform or change the existing power structures in a way that would allow us to grow and to develop. Than that the only way I thought was a kind of separation, a kind of segregation that allowed us to create a black aesthetic of theatre. Because every time, what I was hearing all the time was, you know, the power to create work and determine what kind of shows or kind of plays that would be put on the main, big, the big main stages were always determined by people who were not conversant with the culture. They determined what was a good, what made a good play, what made a classic play. They determined what made the canon. And so for me, I thought the problem there was, maybe we should start thinking of building our own institutions. Maybe we should start thinking, I think like the African-Americans have a very strong tradition, not just of creating work, but also of critiquing it. Their ideologies, their theories, the massive intellectual support from their fellow African-Americans, which there wasn't as much of. There was. It wasn't that there wasn't, there was. But it didn't seem to gain as much visibility. So the question for me then was more to do with pragmatism. It was never a rejection of the situation of what was going on in Britain. It was, well, what do we do next?
So is your solution to this still segregation, a separation of resources?
No.
Separate but unequal?
No, because that's where the problem in separation lies. It's because what happens then is, it then depends on how much money you're given. It's always about resources. Mm-hmm. And that determines which venues you play at, the kind of work that you can create, the longevity of the artists. And so the mainstream has to be your goal. And that's the same whether you're a black, white, Asian, or whatever kind of writer, male or female, whatever kind of writer you are. The mainstream is also the place where you gain the most visibility and you enter the national dialogue. That's the space
Let me move you on very briefly to ask you what you're doing now, because it's clear to me that you're not satisfied with the theatre aesthetic that you found in Britain, the sort of social realist naturalism in which the poor are the poor and black people are black and somehow kind of identity is destiny. What are you working on now to alter that?
It's weird because I'm always thinking 1,000 different things at any given time. And it can be a positive, it can also be a negative, because I'm never near a pen or pencil to write the ideas down. And also it feels like there is no a sort of three-act structure, social realist, conventional style, isn't adequate enough to say what I want to say about Britain, about Nigeria, about the world. It's weird because these ideas come to me in snippets. And yes, I do try to form a coherent narrative around them in my head. But then I get to a point where, when I get to the current narrative, what happens is that the narrative is already the already written narrative of the subject position of a character who would be in such a situation, as you said, the poor person getting poorer, the rich person getting richer. So how do I get out of this bind? How do I create a different kind of narrative that allows us to get away, get out of that system? How do I find a style? And that's something I'm still searching for. I haven't found it. I'm still searching.
Dipo Agboluwaje, still searching, still working, still looking ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dipo Agboluwaje in conversation with Gabriel Badamosi. You can find out more about Dipo on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 249, which was recorded by Gabriel Badamosi and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 250, Mark McCrum speaks with James McConaughey about his first travel writing adventures in South Africa during the last days of apartheid, being sent rather unwillingly for a further book about Australia, and working out what you're writing about as you go along, with emphasis on capturing people's stories. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.